underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Lisa Scottolini is the New York Times bestselling and Edgar Award-winning author of 28 novels, a master of the fast-paced thriller. She is a former civil litigator who left law to raise her daughter. Her writing career began with her first novel, Everywhere That Mary Went, published in 1994, which became a bestseller and was nominated for the Edgar Award. Since then, she's kept writing legal suspense novels, all of which have appeared on the New York Times bestseller lists. In her latest novel, One Perfect Lie, we meet Chris Brennan, although that's not really his name. He's the new teacher and assistant baseball coach at Central Valley High in Pennsylvania. Among his secrets, 6 days from now, there's going to be a bombing. But what does Chris want from the baseball players and families? She's one of our favorites on this program, and it's a pleasure to welcome Lisa Scottolini to this week's book show. Lisa, how are you?
I'm terrific, and thank you for having me back.
It's always a pleasure to have you on the program. So when, as I mentioned in the introduction, the school is Central Valley High in Pennsylvania, having grown up in the suburbs of Philadelphia, I don't know where that is. Where does that, is that a made-up place?
It is a made-up place. Because the real name of the real place where I did my research is Great Valley, and that sounds even more fictional than Central Valley.
Yeah.
But who would believe Happy Valley exists? And
well,
it does in practically every state in the country, so what are you going to do?
So when it comes to this book, you do take a suburban take. This does take place in the suburbs.
Right. Well, I like to look, I mean, people call these domestic thrillers or suburban noir. I mean, as distinguished from the legal suspense series that I write, this is a non-series, it's a standalone. And I like to look at, you know, what's really going on behind the veneer and the chem lawns and the manicures and the foreign cars and the schools. And that whole suburban milieu is an interesting one.
It says right on the jacket under the title, which is One Perfect Lie. The most perfect lie is the one you tell yourself. So do you start off saying, okay, I want to write and I want to explore this idea of a lie?
Yes, exactly. And I was the person who wrote the tagline. So I wrote that tagline and the book all for the same low price. It's incredible.
It's pretty good.
That's what happens. That's how I start a book. I just was like, you know, they say there's something like there's two plots in the world. One is a stranger came to town and the other is a man goes on a journey. And that they're actually both the same plot told from a different point of view,
mm-hmm.
which is actually to me fairly interesting. And that's exactly what this book is. You know, as you said, he's an impersonating a teacher. He's the stranger who comes to town. And so the book is really about what is he doing? Why is he infiltrating this school? Why is he faking these credentials? Why is he scoping out the players on the high school baseball team to figure out who he will manipulate? And at the same time, the people who are reacting to him, like the baseball moms, essentially, and there are three of them, are trying to just cope with him, figure out what he's up to, live their lives, and raise an adult child, which, you know, isn't so easy with teenagers, especially in the age of social media.
So I want to get into those topics, but before we do, there is this idea of how someone can go into a school district, a well-established, assumingly well-run school district, and get that far with fake credentials. Now, we hear about it many times in the news, so it is something that is perfectly plausible, but you do have to wonder how it happens.
Right. And I won't reveal it all herein, but my research showed that exactly what to do and exactly what to say and what forms to fill out and how to fake it. And as you say, it happens with far more frequency than we would like to believe.
So tell us about what the outside world sees of who Chris Brennan is.
Well, that's what's sort of fascinating. That's why I like the tagline of, you know, because there are three different women who are mothers. So the question is, what do they see in him? It depends on who they are. For example, the single mother who really likes him gets a little crushy. I mean, he's interesting and he's single and she's lonely. The widows, there's a mother who's also widowed and she loved her husband very much. What she sees in him is someone who maybe will help her son get a baseball scholarship. And there's one woman, the third, who's in a marriage that looks happy on the surface, but is less so underneath. And she's a little more competitive than the others. And so she wants to make sure that her son, maintains his starting catcher position. And I sort of wanted to look, too, at the kind of, we love team sports and they teach a lot of lessons for sure. But there, I wanted to look at baseball moms and baseball dads and what lessons do we learn from sports and what is the dark side of that as well, especially given the enormous pressure to get scholarships for college these days.
It certainly seems in the book, and you see this all too often in real life, where these families and the lives of these families really do revolve around this baseball team and a coach, in this case, the guy, Chris Brennan.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right. And what are the aspects of suburban life? You know, to me, one of the themes that we're looking at is also with respect to social media, that there's one mother in particular who's very involved with Facebook. And when you talk about the lies you tell yourself, it has struck me early on that Facebook, as an author, I write a book. As Facebook, we all become authors. We all write a story of our own life. Yeah. It's up to you whether it's fiction or nonfiction. My sense is that it's, in some cases, a little of both, and in some cases, completely fictional. And I myself know, there's been times when I've posted a picture and then the next minute got into a fight, And in a way, we create this reality for it, right? And I sort of wanted to look at that mirroring effect. It's very meta. It's kind of like, well, once you put it up on Facebook, do you believe it? Who are you trying to convince? I think it has had a profound effect on the American family.
What kind of Facebook fights are you getting into?
You know what? I don't get into them. Okay. Because here is the key to my life. Ready? I've gotten very zen and I do positivity. So I have actually learned that if somebody writes you something nasty on Facebook, if you just send them some love back, and that will happen because I do all my own social media. So often somebody will write, well, I don't know you said this in your book. And I'll go, thank you very much for your opinion. I appreciate you reading me and your honesty. If you didn't like that book, I'd be happy to send you another one free. They're like, can't even believe that it's you. And it is. A soft answer does turneth away wrath. And I become this little goodwill ambassador for the world. And I truly do think that when you have that kind of a positive agenda, it attracts people like that. And people come to my fiction and my nonfiction, which is very humorous. I write them like Irma Bombeck with my daughter. They come for a resting place from the negativity. They come for a fun escape and a thoughtful escape. I'm happy to provide that. So I don't fight on Twitter. I was a lawyer. Believe me, when I start fighting, you'll know it.
Anyway. I want to get into your legal career in a second. So the three women that we meet, Susan, Heather, and Mindy, as you say, they all come from a different place. There's a competition between them, too, isn't there?
Well, there kind of is. I mean, I think, first, I've always been interested in sort of the gender politics. My other series is Rosato and Associates, and it's about an all-woman law firm. I've been doing that for 15 years. I kind of wanted to think, gee, how would a woman-run firm be different from a male-run firm? And as you confessed, I used to be a lawyer, so now no one will like me, but we'll tell them the truth. And in this case, I sort of think that there's competition among women that happens sometimes, but I didn't even want to explore that per se as much as competition among women because your kid's involved. Like, there's a lot of people. I'll take myself for example. I can be feisty if I have to be, but when it comes to my kid, I'm totally feisty. I will fight for her in a way I would never fight for myself. And that's what these mothers do to a certain extent. I think that's a characteristic of being, a mama bear and a papa bear. The limits for what you would do for your child are a lot farther than what you do for yourself.
So when we talk about going far, what we also realize is how far this character, Chris Brennan, will go to get what he wants. And that is really far.
Right. And with that, and you're so great not to give any spoilers because I work so hard on these twists and turns. But I was also interested in how people manipulate others. And the interesting thing about him is, to a certain extent, he lies for a living. He lies for a business. He lies all the time. So I don't know about you. Maybe you've lived your life better, but I've actually met people like that. And you go, well, are they sociopaths? Are they narcissists? Are they CEOs? Do they run for office? Or are they just the lady next door? posting on Facebook. I mean, I've known people who've, you know, run drives for kids that don't have cancer claiming they had cancer. What causes that kind of personality? What I really wanted to explore that. And it's a little dark, but I think I did the homework. And so I feel pretty confident in spending the time in the novel exploring that with the main character, because there's four viewpoints. His is one, and the moms are the three others.
Lisa Scottolini is our guest. The name of the new novel is One Perfect Lie. Talk a little bit about that research, of how you go to research a novel like this in particular.
Well, it's funny. The part that won't reveal anything is sort of interesting in terms of the writing process, because there's a great serendipity that happens sometimes. I do two novels a year, and as I said, the humorous memoir series. So where do you get your ideas? Sometimes they just come at random. The idea for this book came because I was asked by the Philadelphia Phillies to throw out the first pitch on Ladies' Night. And I was like hugely honored, but also thought, I have no idea how to pitch. Like, I especially in a major league stadium, and I was all nervous. And bottom line is I started to go to the local high school baseball team and just watch them. And sooner or later, I started to observe them, and I observed all the parents, and I observed the relationship of the teammates to each other and to the coach. And that's when I got the idea for One Perfect Lie. It was like, well, what if the coach had a malevolent motive? Because you could see how a good coach can, in a good way, motivate and manipulate someone. You know, a good coach, like a good editor, like a good mom, like a good teacher, will know how to reach you to get you to do your best. And in a way, I just did the flip side of that. So the idea for this book came out of this research was with baseball and baseball teams and 17-year-old boys, which, you know, I have a daughter and she's 30 at this point. It was news to me. And also the effect of social media. See how much, I mean, we sort of know that as an abstract matter.
Right.
But when you see it really, and I sat in 2 days of classes at school and, you know, hung with the kids and sort of just see how they're relating. I wanted that to be an element too, because I think that's very much a fact of the lives of everyone these days, and especially younger people.
First of all, I never thought I could just like you more than I already do, but throwing out the pitch at Citizens Bank, that is a cool thing.
Honestly, it was kind of amazing. And I got to tell you, my knees were weak. And for what it's worth, I did well. I actually got it to the Phillies fanatic. The Phillies fanatic caught me. I mean, how often is that? That's just awesome.
That is an awesome.
Thank you.
That's an
very
awesome thing. So you go and when you sit in, I'm interested in the fact that you sit in classes. And do you get a sense of what that high school experience is like?
You really do. And it's actually very different. I love research because, you know, writing as much as I do basically 2,000 words a day. Well, basically is a lie. I do 2,000 words a day at least. That's my job. And if you do that, you will eventually come out with two novels a year and a short memoir collection, which is kind of amazing. But for me, the fun time is research because there's no word count. And you just sort of soak it in. Now, I have this view that somehow what you learn gets through by osmosis into the novel and informs it, even if you don't really, because you can't shove everything you learn in there. But the way they talk, the way, you know, the fact that, for example, there's three types of sunflower seeds in the dugout, you know, and they all chew it the same way and they can even shell it in their mouth. Like, I don't know if that, I think at one point I had that in a draft of the book, then I took it out. I was like, Lisa, you're fascinated. That's not fascinating. But I get fascinated by everything, which is probably the luckiest thing about my life. I love the research of aspect when you say to somebody like, what's it like to be you? And I sat down with the coach. I spent a full day with the high school coach. What's it like? How do you reach these kids? What do you do when you think a kid's in trouble? Because there's a kid in trouble in this book. Actually, a couple kids in trouble, but one in particular, his father's died, and he was very close to his dad. Gee, when you've been in that situation, coach, how do you reach that kid? Do you want to be his substitute father? How do you help him? And I love educators so much, and coaches are just, as the coach said to me, and I put the line in the book, he said, I'm just a teacher on a ball field. And I'm like, well, that's kind of perfect.
As you were just saying, there's a lot of research, and then you decide, okay, what do I want to include and what do I not want to include? And it would seem to me that would be a conversation that you could have with yourself that is never ending.
That's exactly right. Well, you know, the great saying, great books aren't written, they're rewritten. You know, and that's especially true when it's a suspenseful novel. Whatever the category, I think all novels are all the same, so it doesn't really matter, regardless of genre. You're trying to tell a compelling story, and I secretly think there's lots of keys to that, but the most important key is pacing. So we're talking now, it's a little rambly, I know, and not as tight as I would like to be. In a book, you have to be a lot tighter than, you have to be, by the 37th draft, you will have distilled it down to a point where some review will say roller coaster, and you go, well, that's how I got there. I just took out this. Well, Elmore Leonard has a great line. Just take out the stuff people don't read. It's like, no problem, Elmore.
And I think, because there's great humor in the books, too. And I would think the rewriting, you could, there's a point where you can rewrite so much that you lose funny. Is that something you worry about?
That's a really good point. And sometimes I do worry about that. But I secretly say, unlike real life, with you, I'm just talking to you. We've spoken before. You're fun to talk to. I'm not editing myself. But I've learned that when I write, better to lose it than not. Brandeis had a great quote, you know, better, a guilty man go free than an innocent man be punished. So at some point in life, you got to make your call. Right. And my call in the novels is take it out. Because you're serving a whole, and the whole book will be better, even if this brilliantly funny or brilliantly thoughtful or good, you know, you just don't need everything. The whole will suffer. So don't be so, don't fall in love with your own lines, kid. That's what I sort of say to myself.
But also after, 28 novels, is that a right, is that number correct?
I think it might be.
Yeah. So after 28 novels, I mean, you also know what you're doing too, right? I mean, you look at it and have a sense.
Well, aren't you kind to say so? I hope so. I really honestly try to improve every time, and I try to do something different every time. For example, even though I've written these domestic thrillers that come out every April, I've never done a viewpoint, an alternating viewpoint before. I was like, why don't you give it a try? In the olden days, I didn't even write male viewpoints. I was like, you're a woman, stick with that. And then I was like, well, no, don't be afraid. So then I started writing male viewpoints. And now this book, for the first time, it's like, play with the point of view. This is a novel that lends itself to it. You know, every story has its own dictates, and this story can only be told by shifting points of view. So try not to be afraid and try to write it that way. So I hope that these things improve what I'm doing, but I know that's really my intent. I really want to do better every time.
You spoke about pacing a moment ago. Is that one of the hardest parts of just getting it so that it is something that we can read? I would think you would want this, that we can read very quickly.
I love pacing, and I think it's really important, but it's not the hardest. The hardest thing is what would actually happen next. Because when we make that decision, you're deciding. I always say to myself, people talk about character, plot, and voice as if these are three different elements, and they're not at all. It's just like we used to talk about mind and body as different. We go, oh, your mind influences your body. We go, yeah, that's all right. Well, the real truth is mind and body, in my view, are the same. And voice, plot, and character are the same. So what each character would do next reveals who they are as a person, tells you something about them, and they tell it in their own voice, and it also advances the plot. So what would that person do is the question that I confront every time when I sit down at zero words and have to get to 2,000. You know, the question, I don't write with an outline, like, there you go. I could solve this problem if I had an outline, but that would be like writing Mad Libs for the rest of my life, and I would want to kill myself. So I sit down and go, okay, given what just this last person did in the chapter before, what would this new person do? And that's hard, that's a very interesting task, but that is the hardest task. Pacing is easy compared to that, because pacing is just deletion. Pacing you can deal with in editing. First draft is the hardest, because you don't know what anyone's going to do. You don't even know people say, do you know how your books end? I don't even know how they middle. It's not impressive, Joe. It's not. But it's true. You can tell.
I don't even know how they middle.
I don't.
Lisa Scottoletti is our guest. The name of the new book is One Perfect Lie. So at what point in your life did you say, you know what, I think I can move on. I don't need to be a lawyer anymore.
The story in short was when my daughter was born. And I got divorced at about the same time, which was, don't try this at home, gang. I fell in love with my kid, basically. I was like, this is so fun being home with her. And I don't want to go back to work as a trial lawyer. And I'm broke. And then I thought, you can't get any broker than broke. And it turns out you actually can. Yay. And I did. But I thought, you know, there's John Grisham writing legal thrillers. And at that point, there were no women. And I thought, well, I'm a woman trial lawyer. I was an English major at Penn. I took a course with Philip Roth. I have some pretentious credentials. Why don't I just try and give it a try? And that was like in 94 or something like that. Now I'm decrepit, but here I am. Lucky, lucky, lucky.
So talk to me about going to Penn and Philip Roth and that. I mean, so the original, was that part of the original career goal of say, yes, I want to write. This is what I want to do.
No, my original career goal was to become Perry Mason.
Oh, that's even better.
I mean, that's how far back I go. But I think law is really about justice. Justice just is a compelling subject to me. Wrong, you know, is it moral? Is it right? Is it ethical? Is it legal? There are four questions and they're all separate. And it's nuanced analysis. And I sort of like that about the law. And I put that into the book. So that's my way of saying all my, you know, school loans that I paid off are not wasted. But, you know, there's always elements of justice. In this book, there's justice. In the legal thrillers, the Rosato books, they're pure law or pure legal thrillers. But that justice question is the kind of thing that, right, you open a newspaper, you go, should Madoff have gone to jail? Is it constitutional to declare war? Is it constitutional to have a ban? You know, all of these questions are mixed questions of law and morality and the Constitution of the United States. And I love that stuff. So for the reason it makes people talk over a water cooler, it makes good fiction, I hope.
In addition to writing the fiction, as you mentioned a few times, you also write the column for the Philadelphia Inquirer with your daughter. And it's a humor column, right? It's set up to be a mother-daughter perspective and humorously looking at things in life.
Right. I mean, it just passed our 10th year anniversary, amazingly. And they are now in a series of best-selling books. I think the one coming out is called I Need a Lifeguard Everywhere But the Pool. I mean, the idea is that it's just a woman's life. If you remember Irma Bombeck, it's sort of an update on that, you know, that it's apolitical. It's what we were talking about before. It's not really justice or anything serious. It's really, I like to joke around, as you can tell. And I also like to look at the funny side of things. There's so much humor in life. Mothers and daughters, you know, there's just not a lot in popular culture about that relationship. And in our case, it's a strong one. I mean, we really are best friends. There's so many moms and daughters who are best friends. They all come to the signings. They all clutch the books. We all weep and hug, and estrogen fills the air. And there's nothing in the world wrong with that. I think it's really kind of an underrepresented and underserved. So it's just different women's voices, which, by the way, doesn't mean these books are for women. A lot of men read the column and the books, and certainly most of my thriller readers are men. So, I'm not writing for reproductive organs. I'm writing for souls. That's how I always think of it. I always think of it that way.
So tell me a little bit about the mechanics of writing with your daughter, of how that works.
Well, if you asked her, she would say we do it in different states, and that's the best way to, it's kind of true. We never even know. We do not work together per se that way. She'll tell me what she's worked. Because we really want, at this point, we've done 8 in this series. And she has cultivated a group of, you know, 20 to 30 something followers, and I have cultivated my middle-aged girls. And we want to write separately about each other and about life. So, and then we put them together. Like, for best example is the time she wrote a column about how she was reading the wedding announcements in the New York Times and feeling nervous because she wasn't married yet and counting down from her age. And I wrote a column purely by coincidence that I was reading the obituaries in the New York Times and counting dad and worried because I only, like, 70 is too young to die. I mean, I have died, you know, I'm 61, you know, I'm all like tick, tick, tick. So we're both as neurotic as each other, which is not a newsflash for most mothers and daughters. But so we don't write together per se, but we do have our different viewpoints.
Do you ever, because you were, as you were saying, you do 2 novels a year, plus you write the columns, and those come together as collections. So is that too much? Is that enough? Could there be more? How do you look at that?
I think I secretly have something else I want to do. I mean, I feel so lucky and happy, and I've worked really hard, and over the years, I've had such wonderful readers who have come and stayed with me, and people who read the funny books will come and read the serious books, and the Rosato people will read the standalones like One Perfect Lie, and that's lucky. Since I basically have no personal life, is what I'm trying to tell you, Joe, that my life is pared down to just what I want to do. So I garden, and I read, and I ride a little pony, and I write. I feel like I'm writing at pretty much full throttle, but I think I could even squeeze one more in. There's something I There's some projects I want to do that are in the back of my mind that I'm going to do.
Lisa Scottolini's new novel is One Perfect Lie. It is published by St. Martin's Press. It's always a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much for being with us.
This was so fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.